This is the House Judiciary Committee, February 26, 1985, Subcommittee 2.
Please. This afternoon we'll begin a hearing on House Bill 2336. Mr. Santos and Ms. Crocker.
Which bill is it?
And Ms. Paul.
2336, is that where we're at?
Mm-hmm. 2336.
Thank you. I don't know if that was your idea. There it is.
My secretary said that too.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm Rebecca Crocker. I'm owner of Litron Communications, a business telephone systems company here in Salem, and chairperson of HPAC, Hispanic Political Action Committee in Mid-Willamette Valley. We're here today to present a bill that we feel, HPAC feels, that would be in the best interest of the Hispanic population and the people of Oregon. The Hispanic Political Action Committee, I would like all the other people to be introduced first, I guess, before I get started.
My name is Danny Santos, State President of the Hispanic Political Action Committee, currently a law student at Willamette University.
My name is Anita Paulson. I'm an attorney with Oregon Legal Services, and Representative Kopetsky has asked me to be here more as a resource for the committee because our office has had some experience with problems generated
Okay. The Hispanic Political Action Committee is concerned with the requirements of public health agencies reporting aliens to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. This creates a dangerous health situation at large and especially in the Hispanic community. We believe that HPAC 2336 will help resolve this problem and respectfully request your support. The law under ORS 415-110, state public health agencies are required to report suspected aliens to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The problem: in March of 1983, two migrant farm workers were diagnosed as having typhoid by doctors at the Salud de la Familia Clinic, migrant health facility in Woodburn. The clinic reported the incident of typhoid to the State Health Division. State Health Division interviewed the two workers and then asked them, along with 14 other farm workers who were residing in a labor camp in Hubbard, Oregon, to undergo voluntary quarantine for typhoid. The farm workers all agreed reluctantly. The 14 other farm workers felt uneasy about the quarantine and urged the two diagnosed workers to seek a second opinion. The two diagnosed farm workers went to a chiropractor in Mount Angel. The chiropractor informed these two that they did not have typhoid. The two informed the Sala de la Familia Clinic. The clinic contacted State Health, who in turn obtained a court order to quarantine the 16 farm workers. In the early morning, the 16 farm workers were rounded up. They were handcuffed and transported by Marion County Sheriffs to the Woodburn Middle School. The belongings of these farm workers were left behind. The following Monday or Tuesday, the farm workers were transported to Oregon State Hospital for quarantine. By the end of the week, the Oregon State Health had contacted the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Three INS agents interviewed all the farm workers. Each farm worker was told by an Immigration and Naturalization Service official that if he did not sign a voluntary departure form agreeing to leave the country, that they would be incarcerated indefinitely. Access to the farm workers was denied to everyone until the Marion County Commissioners intervened at the end of the third week. After several weeks of detention, all of the farm workers were released despite the fact that INS had verbal immigration holds on them. Ramifications. The true impact of this incident was to create fear and reluctance among the migrant community in seeking medical assistance. Many farm workers indicated that if they were to go to Sala de la Familia Clinic or seek any other medical assistance, they would get reported to INS. Therefore, these farm workers chose not to seek medical assistance for their ailments. This created a dangerous public health hazard for the entire area. All persons should have access to public health services without fear of reprisals. Persons who go untreated with contagious diseases poses a threat to the whole community. Furthermore, no person, especially Hispanic citizens, likes to be questioned as to her or his immigration or citizenship status when having a medical problem. The bill itself. The purpose of the bill is to resolve the problem of public health agencies reporting suspected aliens to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Section 2 of the bill would repeal the requirement that a public health agency report a suspected alien to INS. Section 1 is a corresponding change. Now, we have support from Sala de la Familia Health Clinic on this, and would take any questions that you have.
First, Mr. Santos, do you want to add anything to the testimony?
Well, I think one thing is the chill and effect aspect of the bill, and of the permanent relations is that quite often people who suspect or at least have suspicion that they may be, they seek medical treatment, may be in fact turned over to INS. And this not only pertains to those who may be here undocumented, but other American citizens who may not have their papers, you know, having your own birth certificate, some other proof of alienage, of U.S. citizenship, often is a concern to U.S. citizens who may try to proceed and obtain proper medical care. So I said, the bill itself does not pertain solely to undocumented workers, but to any citizen who's may suspect that they may be turned over to INS for investigation. So that's our major concern at this time.
Ms. Paulson, do you want to add anything to the testimony?
Our office was consulted several times during this incident by Michael Monos, the director of the program, is now in California looking for law from there, so I couldn't bring him to talk about the case. But we had calls from the clinic and officials in the community and people in the community, and there was a real fear that if people came forward that were exposed, that the same thing would happen to them. And so what our office did see was, in fact, the chilling effect of people possibly being exposed to the point, but being afraid to come forward for medical treatment for fear that they would be reported or deported by immigration. I don't think that health outbreaks like this are really isolated instances. I believe this past summer there was a TB outbreak in Ontario, there have been hepatitis outbreaks in Washington County. I think that you might want to talk to Larry Foster, the Communicable Disease section of the health department, who will probably give you more details. But I think that if we're trying to encourage people to come forward and seek medical attention for communicable diseases, we have to guarantee some protections for them in order to protect our public health lives.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Burton?
See this, Ms. Crocker, Ms. Paulson. When you talk about the problem, I understand what the problem is. And I read the bill here, I get lost. And it's a real short bill, so I'm obviously having some difficulty understanding what I know what you want to accomplish. I fail to see how this bill does that, and so help me along with that.
Well,
in the first section. And let me just try to be specific about what I'm saying here. What you're doing is you're striking from the present statute reference to alien. Okay, but we're leaving it in non-resident public charges. I have some difficulty, I guess, in your both in your testimony here and in the staff report with the term suspected alien. I don't necessarily think aliens are suspect of what. I don't know what that means. I have some problems with that because a person can be an alien in this country and be here legally. What are we talking about? Help me with some terms and definitions and what's the difference between a non-resident alien and alien and that sort of thing.
115.110, that statute requires that any person committed to any state or county institution which is wholly or in part supported by public funds, it's that the health division is an institution that is an involuntary quarantine of those individuals.
So that 415.110, if I may, is this, yes, I need to, I don't, you have that.
It's in the packet.
Let me go through this and do something else while I take a look at that, if you would.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I can understand 415 point. By the way, did the two individuals have typhoid?
Yes. Oh, no, it says in here that they did not.
But that was according to a chiropractor.
Oh.
That's right. In fact, it's our understanding, not knowing all the details in person, that they did in fact need to be quarantined.
They did need to.
You can say it.
When you go to 415.120, wouldn't we be just solving the purpose? 415.110 says is that the institution has to report. 415.120 says upon the official request of the INS immigration officer. I can see the point of saying that a public institution shouldn't have to report, but don't you think it's a good idea that if the INS requests the information that that at that point they could then give the information?
I think it's a very good point. I think one, INS would make such a request upon investigation, proper investigation of the situation, and that's fine. There you have an INS properly conducting its activities, investigating, doing a proper procedural aspect. But simply to leave immigration law to the hands of public health individuals, I think, is a real concern to this kind of community. So
maybe I'd better ask your first name again.
Anita,
when we repeal 415.120, maybe that isn't what we needed to do.
I'm not a drafter of this legislation.
Yeah.
But by my reading of that, what this statute does is it directs upon official request of INS, whatever court or state agency is involved, to furnish to the feds without charge all of the information pertaining to the person that's suspected of being undocumented. So I guess it sort of depends on if the committee wants not only to furnish the information, but if you want the state to pay for the cost of
permission. Representative Bellamy, our legal counsel, I think, is fairly familiar with the immigration laws in this particular statute.
I think part of the problem is this whole chapter, 415, is a bit confusing. 415.120 really only pertains to aliens who are convicted of crimes. This is a different situation than what we're talking about. It's probably was over-inclusive in the drafting.
Okay, so the staff would say that maybe we don't want to repeal.
Correct.
120. The real issue is 415.10.
Correct.
I did notice when I was reading through subsection 3 of 110 that the last sentence on page 70 of that statute requires such aliens to be transported to points designated by the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service. So you might have a statutory directive here that the state of Oregon would have to pay to send people to wherever immigration wants to file them for reading. I mean, I'm not
part of it.
One way or the other.
Let me ask you a question. That's a good point. Let's say that there is a disease outbreak. It might be better for everybody for the state of Oregon to send them someplace. Even if it costs us, if we're talking about a major outbreak, and maybe we ought to have a response to that.
I think there's the real dilemma. I think, one, you may be looking at isolated numbers of people here who may, after the proper investigation, may be determined to be illegal. But once again, our concern there is that you're going to have health officials making some kind of determination as to suspects. Second of all, that kind of a determination by a public health official are going to lead to what I think is a counterweighing argument saying that, well, why should we, in fact, go to or assess ourselves to public health services, even in a dangerous situation, such as a contagious disease? And I think the outweighing factor has to be the public health aspect versus a questionable taking out suing immigration law by public health officials.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Speaker.
I think the question that's been raised about 415.120 is probably appropriate, and it may be necessary to rewrite 415.110 as well, because it seems to talk about, or at least the way I read it, it's talking about jails, and it's also talking about health providers. And I just know in Multnomah County, as a matter of course, that people who are arrested in Multnomah County, usually on misdemeanor charges, immediately upon determination that that person may not be properly a resident or have appropriate alien status here, INS is called. Most times the criminal proceedings are dismissed if it's a misdemeanor and that person's put on the bus and sent back south. And I guess that may be an evil in itself, or maybe, I don't know, but I don't think you want to confuse your issue with that situation, whether it's a good situation or a bad situation. I think that's probably beyond the focus that you're bringing to us today.
That's true. Our primary focus in introducing the bill, is there's all aspects involved here, but our primary focus was on the health, public health issues.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowen.
When drafting on line 10, it says from funds, line 9, it says from funds appropriated for that purpose upon vouchers approved by the division and the superintendent of public instruction.
Institution.
Public institution. Okay. Maybe I could ask staff to tell us what that line means. I think I read it.
I don't know.
I doubt if these folks know what that paragraph was put in there for.
I don't know.
It could be either facility transfers, but I'm not sure. Of course,
that's already existing law. Right? I was going to say, it's in the existing 15.
It's in book 179.010.
That's an assistant
Mental health and corrections is 179.010.
Yeah.
So just this one chapter.
That's it. So it's corrections, mental health division. So it could be something beyond interagency or interest. It could be out of country as well. If it's corrections as well, it could mean to pay the cost of deportation as well. But we can research that before the hearing and work session. Representative Springer?
I guess I would ask, the more I read this chapter in ORS, the more I think it's suspect throughout. I don't know where it talks about any person who brings or in any way aids in bringing into the state any public charge who not a resident of the state is going to be legally responsible for that. Is there any way we can try to determine when or if this has ever been enforced or ever challenged in court? The whole thing just I guess it's been around since 1957, but I think we've probably moved a little bit in our thinking since then. I see all kinds of problems with the chapter, but that's aside from your particular problem. And as long as we've got it before us, I suppose we might want to look at the whole thing. So that's a question and maybe some research that Rock here, because I know we've got a couple of legal students helping us out. Maybe that's a good task for them, too.
And I'd still like to go back to my original question about what the definition of a non-resident. The chapter defines resident, but it doesn't define non-resident. I assume that's the opposite of a resident, but there may be some other language around that. I also assume a lot of these portions of this particular chapter repealed in 1957, so it probably predates, the original language probably predates that.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank the Hispanic community for bringing to us obviously a point that needs to be looked at. I would also offer that I'll send the copy of this chapter to my local DA in Jefferson County, who has had a lot of experience in this area, and give us some ideas if these things in here are totally unenforceable by Oregon law.
The other items in there.
Yeah,
you're looking at
the whole. I would be happy to do that.
That's wonderful. I think, is this scheduled?
For work session Friday.
This Friday. How about a quick telephone call?
I think we can arrange that.
Wonderful. Thank you. Is there any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Fleisman. Please. I asked Mr. Fleisman to comment on this bill, and I explained that I think it was the intent of the to at least limit the bill to the as it relates to the medical community. And if we're doing something beyond that area, then we'll bring that up in the work session. But good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Pete Fleissner, and president of the Oregon Association of Hospitals, and I am here on request. The language in 415.110 is, I think, ambiguous at best. It talks about a person committed. It doesn't say voluntarily or involuntarily, and both terms are used in Oregon law. To any state or county institution, which is supported wholly or in part by public funds. Apparently, this language has been interpreted by some hospital people to include Medicaid as support wholly or in part by public funds. If that's the case, if that's the interpretation, then I believe at least the health component of this government field is really not the business of healthcare purveyors to inquire into one's national origin or criminal record or anything else. So our concern is to take care of the people who present themselves to us. So if it includes us, I'd like to encourage you to take us out. If it does not, then I guess it's moot. There's another element that doesn't appear here. There are some hospitals that you would have public support in the form of tax support that are not state or county, they're district hospitals. And they do receive, some of them receive some tax support. I'm not sure what bearing that has, if any, but it's as a matter of information. That's it. I have nothing further, Mr. Chairman, unless there are questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Just, Pete, do we have any county hospitals left?
Yeah, we have five.
Oh, we do. Okay.
That's Wallowa, Morrow, Kearney, Curry, and Tillamook. And only two of those, and I'm pretty sure I'm correct, only two of those receive tax money, and of course, county tax money. There are 15 district hospitals, and I'm guessing that about 10 of them, or 9 of them, receive some tax money.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much. Thank you for stopping by this afternoon. Are there any other witnesses here for House Bill 2336 that did not sign up on the...
What I can do is wait until the next bill comes up, 2337. And then
oh, I'm sorry. Is this her? Are you Vieta?
Yeah.
You're the last on the list.
Okay, so I can do both jointly. Okay.
Oh, I see. I'd rather treat this bill separately than the next one. But so if you want to testify on this one now?
My testimony covers both.
Okay, we'll wait then. We'll close the hearing on 2336 and open the hearing on 2337. Council, do you... So we do have some material for... Kelsey, do you want to talk
sure.
quickly describe the marriage?
Sure. Immigration law is federal law and deals with civil law. And this is enforced by the Immigration and Naturalization Service only. The Immigration Service has specialized training in immigration law and its enforcement. There is no authority for local law enforcement agencies to enforce immigration laws. Nevertheless, some local law enforcement agencies have tried to enforce immigration laws. They have been subjected to lawsuits in court and have lost. And this has created an expenditure of money and time in these lawsuits for city and county governments.
Good luck.
Yeah. Hello again. Could you identify yourselves for the record, please?
Rebecca Crocker, chairperson for Mid Willamette Valley HPAC Committee.
Danny Sankos, state president for HPAC. You have our written testimony before you, and I'd just like to quickly take you over that. Your legal counsel has provided you a review of what most of our testimony will pertain to. But simply, HPAC comes to you for support and in concern about the local, county, and state law enforcement of federal immigration law. We believe that House Bill 2337 will solve this problem and respectfully request your support. Under the United States Constitution Preemption Clause, the Immigration and Naturalization Act, U.S. and the U.S. Attorney General's of Bell's opinion, Attorney General, Oregon Attorney General Redden's opinion, and several court decisions, it is clear that state and local law enforcement officers have no authority to enforce immigration laws. The authority to enforce immigration laws is delegated to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The majority of law enforcement agencies seem to understand the law and do not attempt to enforce immigration laws. However, some local law enforcement agencies have attempted to enforce immigration laws by themselves or in conjunction with INS. The justification for these illegal practices are threefold. They have done it in the past and do not understand why they cannot continue to do so. They are sworn to uphold the laws of this country and are doing so by looking for illegal aliens. They do not understand the law because there is no state statute covering this matter. The courts have said that these are not valid reasons. In Oregon, there are several lawsuits regarding this illegalities, and we recorded one for you, Trevino versus the City of Independence Police and Polk County Sheriff's Office. For another case, you might also refer to De La Serna versus INS in the Federal District Court. The ramifications of illegal enforcement. Hispanic and other ethnic minorities, including U.S. citizens, are detained, interrogated, and harassed by local law enforcement agencies on the basis of skin color, language, and dress. This is a violation of one's right to privacy and constitutional rights. Hispanic and other minorities are treated as second-class citizens. Number two, law enforcement agencies are not trained in immigration law. Local police are usually trained only in criminal law, which remains fairly constant. Immigration law, however, is not criminal, but civil law, and is constantly changing. INS agents are especially trained in the enforcement of immigration laws. Number three, local governments have to expend money out of their own coffers in defending these types of cases. They are also quite time-consuming. In most cases, local government's insurance does not cover civil rights violations. and therefore additional legal counsel must be retained. This is costly to local governments, not to mention increasing the court's caseloads. High priority criminal law enforcement and investigation is being subdued for the purpose of enforcing low priority non-criminal matters. This does not set well with the local taxpayers, especially the Hispanic taxpayers, when local law enforcement agencies are trying to justify their budgets. The purpose of the bill is to resolve the problem of local law enforcement agencies enforcing federal immigration laws. The bill is a restatement of what the law is and will give a Oregon statute citation of what the law is. Hopefully this bill will better educate the local law enforcement agencies as to what the law is. We can offer any assistance in this bill in any matter affecting, in any other matter affecting Hispanics, we would be happy to do so. And as far as legislative background, ironically this bill did pass the House last session by a 40-11 vote. It also passed the Senate chamber by a 17-11 vote, but due to the House rules regarding the House bills, they were passed under different House bills and therefore technically did not have the proper passage.
And that was in 1983.
That's correct.
Ms. Paulson, did you want to?
I was asked to find some examples of instances where people have been afraid because